My name is Frances Leader, and I've been a British anti-war activist for 53 years, since 1967. I've also done quite a few different jobs at the same time and been a mother, and I'm now a grandmother, and I live in Dorset.
What was it in 67 that got you going, Fran?
Vietnam. Yeah, obviously. In 1967, guys that were only a couple of years older than me were getting whisked off to Vietnam and dying in their thousands, and I was just so appalled by it, because I grew up in central London, in playing in bomb sites. To me, war was a very raw thing. It was something I grew up with when I was a little kiddie. There were no playgrounds where I was. There was just bomb sites, and we played building little houses out of all the broken bricks and all the knickknacks that were laying around. Some of those craters were so deep, they must have gone back to about the 10th century. The filth that we were playing around in the East End of London was quite something. But the impression that that made on me throughout my childhood was that war, I actually believed that the whole world looked like that. I believed the whole world had been bombed, because my mum told me it was a world war. So I assumed the whole world looked like that. I didn't know anything about green fields or trees or, I was really central London, and it was smog city. You know what it was like in those days? They called them the pea soupers. So when in 1969 I was 17, and I was hearing about boys of 19 going out to Vietnam and getting killed because they were invading a country they had no reason to be in, it took me really by the soul. The thought that there were more kids going to grow up in bomb sites was too much for me. So I took myself off. I bunked the trains. I got into London, and I attended the demonstrations outside the US Embassy. And that was how I started.
What about other campaigns over the years, Fran?
After that, I was still at school then. After that, I got involved with anything to do with animals. I moved out from London. Obviously, anyone with any sense does. I moved out to the coast and went to live in Clacton-on-Sea, and there was a whale called Nemo that was in the old swimming pool on the pier, and I'd seen him a couple of times, and I went along one time, and his dorsal fin was flopped right over, whereas it hadn't been before. And he was lackadaisical. He wasn't really active in the water the way he had been before. And I started to worry about him. So I got in touch with Greenpeace and worked on getting that whale removed from the pier, which resulted in death threats from the pier owners. And, quite a war went on in our town. But thankfully, I had an awful lot of support from local people, and we did a barefoot walk from Clacton Pier to Walton Pier and back, raised money, and Greenpeace eventually footed the bill, and it was a colossal bill, more than $1 million, to get him out of that pier and over to Miami, and that's where he fathered a baby. So I was he recovered from being ill. And he fathered a baby. So that was my very first real joyful successful event that I took part in. After that, I was at Greenham Common via Essex University. I took part in some activism that I really don't think I can speak about. And then more recently, anti-fracking.
Because the fracking has been an enormous success, hasn't it, actually? At least that's what it certainly appears, that the frackers have won with the announcement that there's not going to be any fracking, even though there is, I mean, there's obviously an impetus for this because of the question marks over the oil supply. What do you think was the main reason why the fracking campaign has been so far successful here in Britain?
Well, we worked very, very hard. We were, you know, all over the UK team, and we all worked very hard to bring it into the public eye. To be honest with you, I think the actual geological structure of the UK works in our favour more than any other thing, and that was always our point from the start, that the UK is so seriously fractured in its geology that whenever you want to drill for oil, you're going to have to do it every few miles in order to be able to access each little bit, because it's been fractured and slipped to another level to find the next bit. It's not one long slab of shale across the country like they've got in the Marcellus shale in America. It's not like that. And I think the geology worked against the frackers far more effectively than we did. And so we can thank Great Britain for its structure, for saving us from the dreaded oil and gas industry.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? And also, I remember reading a book called Most Secret War, which was written by the scientific advisor to Winston Churchill during World War II, that shale oil and fracking was one of the things that the Nazis were desperately proposing at the end of World War II, in you know, late 1944, early 1945, because they hadn't got any access to oil, and obviously they needed fuel to run their tanks and everything else, and it seems to me that fracking was something which is a sort of last ditch desperate attempt for people with no real access to oil to do this, because it always seemed to me, Fran, maybe you can correct me, but that it was always on the margins of whether it was actually going to be economic to do it.
I don't think it's been economic to do it at any point since they brought the thing into this country. I don't think that's the only reason for wanting to frack, because fracking itself as a process was invented in 1963 for the purposes of disposing of nuclear fuel waste. So I think that was the secondary and possibly the more important motive for trying to frack the UK. It was interesting to me that they put their first wells, quadrilla drilled in Lancashire, were right close to, within 8 miles of, a storage facility for nuclear fuel and nuclear waste. And we have been, as a nation, importing nuclear waste for a long time. Now, I've often wondered, why on earth would we do such a thing? Why would we import other countries' nuclear waste without somewhere that we were sure we were going to be able to put it? And then, lo and behold, everyone was on about fracking all the way across from just outside Manchester right the way across to Hull. And it all clicked together in my head. I thought, oh, I see. It's not about the oil or the gas. They'll get a little bit of that, and that'll, you know, pay a few of the bills. But the real earner is in disposing of nuclear waste, because that's going to be eternal. And those wells would need to be maintained and cared for. So it's going to be like forever. Those companies will be on an earner from the government looking after the nuclear waste deposits down these wells. When I revealed that fact on Richie Allen's radio show, I think it was a couple of years back now, it was a good while, all of a sudden fracking didn't seem to happen anymore. It all kind of like died. And I was able to back up what I was saying with you know, proof that that was what fracking had been invented for in the first place, because I had newspaper articles from 1963 in America where they had done this. So I don't know if that contributed more than I'm, you know, maybe I'm being a little bit, it's guesswork. I don't know what got contributed to Quadrilla suddenly just giving up, but they did. And I'm so glad they did.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the Richie Allen show, because I think most people in this country are gobsmacked, really, by the bias we're seeing now in our mainstream press. And thank God for people like Richie and others who are keeping the candle burning for the truth, because this is what we want. And we, you know, what's been going on in most of the mass media, almost all of it, in fact, is that we've been getting extremely biased. You know, in other words, so many of the doctors involved in this whole COVID crisis, if you can call it a crisis, it seems to me to be, you know, mainly manufactured, but so much bias involved in it. It's been quite good to have various people criticising the propagandistic side of it. But what we had in the 1960s and 70s, a bit less so in the 80s, but we had a kind of golden age in broadcasting where the TV was great to watch. You know, we had brilliant satire. Things like Not the 9 o'clock News, right the way back to even the goodies, taking the mickey out of our politicians and our priests and all this sort of thing. And the internet came along in the 90s and sort of took the place of that. As the TV was being shut down, in you know, around about to the time, by the time of 9/11, there was no investigative journalism left, really. And of course, that's quite important.
Why do you think that happened, Tony? Why? What do you, I mean, you're the journalist, you were around at the time. What was it that caused that to happen?
Well, I think it was a deliberate shutdown of investigative journalism. There were all sorts of things going on in the early 90s, mid-90s. I mean, one of the most important things, you know, I would suggest, is a book called The Fifth Man, written by Roland Perry, an Australian journalist, which exposed the role of Victor Rothschild as the fifth man, you know, the most important spy in World War II, who was giving the secrets to Stalin before Churchill even knew what was going on. Stalin was way ahead of the game. And, you know, obviously there were the others, Burgess and Maclean and Philby and Anthony Blunt. You know,
I remember him.
And Blunt really was the most problematic of the lot in a way, because he had been... What had he been? He'd been over to Germany at the end of the Second World War in order to get hold of a load of papers that had been, well, letters of correspondence between the German royal family and Queen Victoria about starting the First World War. Okay, so Blunt's job was to go and grab all that material before any of the Americans, the Russians, or the British forces found it. And, you know, make sure it was all shredded and burnt. And that was Blunt's role. But that's why he was very, very close to the royal family. And he was obviously protected by the royal family. But I think the exposure of Victor Rothschild as a Soviet agent was quite important, because obviously that was all about the creation of the State of Israel. And he was right at the heart of British intelligence right the way through. He was appointing the heads of MI5 and MI6 and maybe GCHQ too. He was certainly involved in controlling the BBC through getting the director generals appointed and sacked and that sort of thing. So, you know, that might be simply that, but I think it was also the fact that the Yinon plan was rolling along, and there was there's a push for a war in the Middle East, you know, balkanization of the Middle East. So thank you for asking me a question. I'm normally asking other people questions. I think they were making sure that there was going to be no actual real investigative journalism left in Britain by the time 9/11 happened, Fran.
Yeah, that sounds like a feasible explanation when you consider that Queen Victoria, when you mentioned Queen Victoria, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, that was the beginning of the Saxe, Coburg and Gotha reign on the British throne. And the empire is their empire. And to call it the British Empire, actually, I find quite offensive, because we were used to gather that empire for the Saxe, Coburg and Gotha, who are the top family in the black nobility, whose other name is the Guelf or Welf of Germany. So I can well see why investigative journalism was curtailed as hard as it could be to prevent journalists from going that far and realizing just how much all of Europe is being, and always has been, manipulated by the royal families to make them as much money as possible and to genocide the populations of Europe. And they're trying to do it again. I think that they are the most heartless users and abusers this world has ever known. And I think that that being revealed by investigative journalists would have been far too much. And more heads would have rolled if anyone had dared to expose those facts.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's another thing going on in the background in Victoria's time, of course. And I picked a lot of this up from a guy called Anton Chaitkin, whose son Jacob Chaitkin, he was the advisor, well, he was the strategist and the chief lawyer for the US Jewish boycott of Nazi Germany, Jacob Chaitkin, his dad. But Anton has pointed out quite a lot to do with things like the rise of the evangelical movement and the Pentecostal movement and the way that they were controlled. Basically, the idea is, you know, you've got to control these various aspects of Christianity, of Islam, of Judaism, you know, and the main thing there I found quite fascinating, Fran, was looking at and this is David Livingstone's work that he's done with his book Transhumanism, the History of a Dangerous Idea, and his other stuff, which his most recent one is this online book, which has got all sorts of interesting multimedia called Ordo Ab Chao, which is the slogan from the Scottish Rite Freemasonry. You know, Albert Pike was the master of that. Is, and of course, this is all linked in the Victorian era to the same thing, which is the destruction of faith through the use of Darwinism, right? So the idea is anyone that thinks that, you know, that humanity is a created thing is crazy, is mad. And so that once that had started to kick in the early 1900s, that there were less and less and less people believed in God. So that's when their theosophists came along, right? So the idea is, oh, you can actually now believe in something, you know, this other dimension to life, the spiritual, but it's spiritualism. And it's something completely different, like mediums and all this sort of thing, which is not, you know, it's a different version really of what spiritual really means. But they wanted their version to sort of pick up where people obviously realized that there is another dimension to things. And those that did were steered down the theosophical route by all this. But, you know, there's quite a lot, I think, fascinating stuff went on at the end. In fact, I think it's Ian Fleming as well, the Bond author. Yeah. He was also sent in to do a similar mission. To get rid of correspondence between the British royal family and certain, you know, aristocrats in Germany right at the end of World War II. So there was a lot of evidence that they needed to sweep up and burn before the end of World War II.
It makes me wonder, you know, I think about my grandparents. I absolutely adored my grandparents. And they went through both First and Second World Wars in their lifetime. And I think about how much faith they had in being British, and they never realised just how much they were all being used, and I find that just so sad. I'm really glad they never lived long enough to find out how they were used.
Well, I definitely think that the British Empire was used to spread Christianity, and it did quite well while it was doing that. But the point being is, once you've got that empire in your country and everyone's smiling, you know, they're saying, oh, this is quite a nice faith here, you know, Jesus seems like quite a nice guy. Once they're in there, they kind of turn the tables on the population, and they say, "Well, oh, by the way, we didn't really believe any of that stuff." Right. Anyway, look, what we're talking about really useful to look at. Obviously, the mainstream press is turned into this kind of the worst edge of the sort of Soviet style thing, which is extremely biased. Less and less people believe in it. More and more people are throwing things at their TVs and radios. But there is social media, and there is alternative media of various sorts still out there. I know this week you had a few little run-ins with Twitter, didn't you?
Yeah. The government has got the 77th Brigade, Army Brigade, working on Twitter full-time. And I think that I suddenly noticed an uptick in the amount of their operatives that were pestering me on my tweets, and I just merrily went along blocking them as much as I could. But it seems like they've now taken a new tack where they are lurking rather than communicating and reporting anything that doesn't follow the prescribed narrative on any subject. And then this morning at 9 o'clock, I got a notification from Twitter saying that I was temporarily suspended because I'd put up a post that connected COVID-19 symptoms with the symptoms that are commonly known to come from millimeter wave electromagnetic frequencies, such as...
Okay, look, let me stop you there, because you don't get a runny nose or you don't get a cough, surely, from being too close to a mobile phone mast.
Yes, you do. I looked into this ages ago, and all of that research has come together in some declassified documents that I got from the CIA. The first few that I found were dated in the 60s and had only recently been declassified. And what they were saying was, what they described was really quite extreme symptoms can be caused by different frequencies of electromagnetic energy, and they had even experimented to find out what frequencies cause what reactions in living things. And this was then corroborated by a translated Russian study, which went even further in explaining the number of different symptoms that can be caused. It literally depends which frequency is and at which pulse rate that frequency is delivered into the atmosphere. It depends on that, what the reaction amongst not just people, but all living things will be.
Okay, have you actually got any real hard evidence of this? Because there's obvious questions here.
First of all, Fran,
that the CIA do put out complete disinformation, as we know, the idea being to sort of lay man traps for people to fall into. But also, if you're going to get, are you saying there's no virus? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that is exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying that Pasteur and his entire allopathic medicine needs chucking in the bin. And it should be replaced by Bechamp and his terrain therapy.
So what about all these flus and viruses and colds and things that I've had over the years before 5G was ever invented?
Oh, that's not a problem to explain at all. You do know that I'm a barefoot doctor of Chinese medicine, don't you?
No.
You didn't know that? Okay. In Chinese medicine, a cough and a cold in the winter months is a cleaning operation that is done by the lung channel. It does it as regularly as it can. It will usually pick a period when you're actually very healthy to have a little clean out of the lung channel.
Yeah, but we all catch these things off other people.
No,
someone
we don't.
Got it.
No.
Yes, we
no,
do. No, I've caught colds off. I've caught colds off my family, my friends.
Yeah, well, those are bacterial infections you're talking about. There are. I'm not denying there's bacteria. I'm saying we'll take the word virus for. Let's go back to the root of the word virus. It comes from Latin, and it means poison. And so anything that they are saying is a virus is not. It's a poison. So if you get what they are now calling a viral infection, we should be calling it a poisoned infection. And if you're in the same environment as half a dozen other people who are also subjected to the same poisoned environment as you, of course you're all going to get similar symptoms. It's okay, bloody so obvious.
The Chinese and the French and others actually releasing the gene sequence of the COVID. Well, actually, it was the SARS-CoV-2, which is the same thing as COVID-19, the genome of the virus, and examining it in virology departments.
No, they're not. The very first genomic sequence that was found was in February 2020, put out in a study from Wuhan. And every other study that has been done since has referred back to that study for the genomic sequence. So what they're finding all over the place is matches for that genomic sequence. Now, if you look at that genomic sequence, you realize that that could quite easily be an exosome, a natural result of a cell throwing out toxic matter. So if a cell is attacked by electromagnetic radiation, it will do whatever it can, parcel up as much as it can in a protein envelope and throw it out of the cell wall. That's what's being seen as a virus, but it's actually a poisoned wrapped up in protein. So then they took this genome, and I read the original paper from Wuhan with the original genomic sequence. And then I tried to find the root source of that sample that they got that genomic sequence from. And eventually I found a small note in the notes at the bottom of the study saying that the original sample was supplied by one doctor from Wuhan Laboratory. So they had supplied a genomic sequence, and the whole world has matched that sequence and claimed that it is SARS-CoV-2. What it actually is an exosome thrown out by cells under attack from electromagnetic radiation. That's why it boomed up in Wuhan first, because Wuhan turned on thousands of 5G smartphones all at the same time. They gave them out for free. Everybody was getting loads and loads of iPhones in and around Wuhan, and they all went on at the same time, and they literally dropped like flies. The next thing to happen was in northern Italy, the same performance. The 5G was turned on, boom, people started getting ill with this reaction to the electromagnetic frequency. And I don't know if you remember, but when the Chinese finally came to the end of what they called their viral infection, it was very sudden and abrupt. I think what they did was change the frequency of the 5G and stopped it dead in its tracks. I'm not the only one who thinks this, obviously. There are a number of studies that have been done. There's a Spanish doctor who wrote a comparison of geographical places that have suffered from spikes of COVID-19 and whether or not they had 5G, and it was across the board. When you look at a map of Great Britain, which has got the layout of COVID-19 and then look at a map of the layout of 5G and they match. It's not something that people want are allowed to say. I have been sending.
Okay, so what happened with Twitter, Fran?
Well, somebody reported two of my posts about this subject. One was from Claire Edwards, a film that had been released on BitChute of her giving a press conference, saying more or less what I've just told you. And that was one. And the other one was two maps side by side of the 5G and the COVID, where you could see how much they correlated. These two were flagged up to Twitter, and they suspended me. So, and they first of all they asked me if I would be prepared to remove the two articles, and undergo 12 hours of restricted use of Twitter, or I could appeal. So I decided that it was the principle of the thing. I knew I was right. I knew that Claire Edwards was right. She used to work at the UN. She knows her stuff. And I thought, well, I'm going to stick on this principle, even though it is breaking their rules and opposing what the official narrative is. I'm still going to stick to what I believe in, because I believe it wholeheartedly with the amount of work.
Let's set aside for a minute whether you're right or wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is something rather creepy coming along here, isn't there? The idea that Twitter determines what is and is not allowed to be discussed.
Well, they said on their comment to me, I just got the impression that this is something they've agreed with the British government and the US government, that, you know, they've been told that they are not to permit alternative explanations for the COVID-19 outbreak. Full stop. You've got to believe what they're telling you. You're not to look for an alternative cause, and certainly not to look for an alternative treatment. And unless you know the true cause of a disease, there's no way you're ever going to find the treatment. I mean,
well, that's fascinating, isn't it? Because the government themselves, right at the start of all of this, decided to the wise way to deal with this was to clear the hospitals out and move lots of people, elderly people, into care homes, some of whom actually had contracted COVID. So that itself was a horrific act. And they're saying that actually social media and mainstream media should not be able to criticise government policy.
What they did to those old people is nothing short of murder, in my opinion. That was unforgivable, completely unforgivable. I got the impression that we were supposed to be going on lockdown to protect the elderly. And when we discovered that they had emptied out the hospitals into care homes, it was obvious that that was the completely wrong thing to do, because it immediately compromised all the care homes and their staff, and it was murder, in my opinion. It was murder.
So, okay, so what's the outcome with Twitter? They've had a little look at your case.
Yeah, they took all day. I decided to appeal, and that was by about 9:30 this morning. I sent in my appeal.
So do you get much of a chance to appeal? Do you get a lot, you know, you have to send in a written appeal to them, do you?
Honestly, Tony, they are really limited. They give you a 140-digit space in which to make your appeal. There was no waxing lyrical, I can assure you. I just had to phrase my answer as best I could and say that I considered the material I had shared was from legitimate sources, which it was. An ex-UN official and on the one hand, and both maps came from government sites.
Okay, so that's within about 25 words to do your appeal in.
Yeah.
This is not the High Court, is it?
No. But so I seriously just sent it off and went off to Facebook and spent the rest of the day on Facebook utterly convinced that I was going to be thrown off of Twitter forever for breaking their rule about obeying what the prescribed narrative is. So at 7 o'clock this evening, I was most stunned to get an email saying that they were deeply sorry and very apologetic, but they appeared to have made a mistake.
Anyway, that's some good news to share. And
oh,
it shows
I
you that
delighted.
it is worth, you know, if you've got good sources for your material, just sending that in. Look, what about the lockdowns, though? Because we're coming into apparently phase two of all of this, and both the Scots and the Welsh, who have their own little independent assemblies, which
so
are
they say.
Pretty much loyal to Brussels, and the north of England too, are going into these lockdowns. What do you make of everything that we're going through at the moment, Fran, as a seasoned, long-time campaigner?
We've never seen anything quite like this before, have we? And I've had sight of a transcript from a memo that was leaked to the president of the Gambia, and he read it out in a speech, which you cannot find for love nor money anymore. I think it's still got one copy on BitChute. And this particular memo laid out in graphic detail exactly what all these lockdowns are planned to do. So it's quite a shocking thing, but they plan to have the whole world in full lockdown for November and December to literally terrorize everyone into believing in this virus. And meanwhile, they will be increasing the rollout of 5G. Well, they've been working like blazes all the way through this summer, all the way through the lockdowns that we've already had to get this 5G up and running.
Well, one of the things I will say is that in Bristol, the anti-5G campaigners have been appealing against all of the 5G masts that have been going in, most of them anyway, and they've been very successful. Something like 80% of them they've managed to stop. So they did that in a very sneaky manner during the lockdown. All these planning applications went in. But there's been quite a successful attempt in Bristol. I'll also say that the Freya Lockwood, who is Bristol Smart City's chief, she's partly paid out of the council taxpayers' money, and she's very much pro 5G, and she is a former employee of Kinetic, so she's come from Salisbury Plain, you know, and in a way it's not totally surprising, because this is actually a military system. The data that we have on our phones was originally developed by the British Army to send maps and things to their soldiers in the field, and but I mean, you know, when you have these privatised military organisations, literally paid for by the council, lobbying within the council for private profit to be made out of 5G, it's quite worrying, shocking and surprising that sort of thing doesn't really seem to be being looked at by our journalists at the BBC, ITV, the local newspaper and that sort of thing. But anyway, you know, where are we heading with all this then, Fran? Do you think, because it seems to be sort of dividing society, almost like a cell dividing, with some people going along with the idea of, you know, we've got a never-ending pandemic, a bit like the never-ending wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the rest, and others who are saying, actually, we're having none of this.
That's right. That's intentional, though, isn't it? Because it will keep the public at each other's throats rather than investigating the real root causes. Because when people get frightened, they will turn on those who are not frightened, and say it's because of you, you know, that you're the cause of this larger second wave. We told you so. It was too early. This is all your fault. Just because you needed a haircut. Blah, blah, blah. And it's, and now it's the masked versus the unmasked. The polarities are always being exploited. They exploit the polarity to keep us warring amongst ourselves so that we don't turn around and look who is implementing this. When meanwhile, the World Economic Forum has its website chock-a-block with evidence that they are working towards United Nations Agenda 21/2030 and the SDGs. They're going full steam ahead towards a totalitarian one world government, one currency, one religion, and they're doing it all simultaneously. Rockefeller brought out a document in 2010, and everyone's been going on about the lockstep scenario that was in that document. And I've been saying, no, hang on, stop. Look at the document again, because there were four scenarios in that document, and they were like fictitious scenarios. They were even presented in the past tense, as if they had already happened. But when you read all four, not just the lockstep, but all four of those scenarios, they are all being implemented in the world simultaneously. The state of confusion is caused by the fact that some countries are doing some aspects of it and other countries are doing other aspects of it. But ultimately, they will all adopt all of each other's ideas. All these four scenarios will meld together to create this one single world government that they've been aiming for.
Can I put you on the stop, on the spot here? And
go on then, yeah.
Talk about those four. What are the four different scenarios?
They're very complex. I couldn't go into.
All right. Well, let's not go there then. Okay. So what?
You'd need to read the document.
Yeah, okay,
really.
That's fine. Yeah. And I will. So what can we do about this, Fran?
Well, the only thing that I have, I've been really working on this now since January, since Wuhan very first kicked off. And I have tried to meditate and think my way through what would be our best move. And this comes back to something you said earlier about the media is completely and utterly unreliable and untrustworthy and untrusted. So we have to provide a solid, strong alternative to the mainstream media. And via people like yourself and Richie Allen and the Light Truth paper, I don't know if you've heard about that, have you?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Via these kind of projects, we are capable of at least providing the public with food for thought. So that instead of just swallowing the prescribed narrative wholesale, we look for alternatives, because there is only one truth. There can be a million lies, but there can only be one truth. And it's up to us to be diligent and work hard and find that truth. I'm prepared to accept the fact that a lot of people believe in viruses. I don't. I'm prepared to accept the fact that a lot of people think that vaccines, the flu vaccines, are putting these poisons into people, and that's causing the illnesses that are going on. I don't care how many different points of view I get to hear, as long as we get to hear them. And the only way we're going to do that is by providing a really solidly good, open alternative media like you do and like Richie does, thankfully, and now Darren Nesbitt with his Light Truth newspaper, the light paper. Why we never thought of this before amazes me. You know, it's been obvious really that was what was needed.
Right, well, that kind of threats to the system, humanity, people's lives, livelihoods, friends, relatives, loved ones, does actually sort of bring people together. And I wonder if that's one of the most interesting things that's come out of this, is that as the lockdowns destroy people's livelihoods, etc., then people become actually much more reliant on each other, Fran.
Well, all negatives have a positive outcome. They all do. Even the darkest of dawns has to give way to the light, doesn't it? And no matter how miserable and dark and dismal it gets, it seems to me that, you know, it's a dark, dark tunnel. But we are the light in that tunnel. We know that we're being misled, that we've been lied to, that we're misgoverned. And we know that there are hidden agendas that are now becoming quite obvious. So this is a form of light. It's the light of understanding why we are being manipulated and where we're being manipulated to, so that we can simply go, no, we are not going there. We don't want to be under a tyrannical, totalitarian world state that seems to, all it wants to do is annihilate all our different cultures all around the world, which to me is just the most appalling idea.
I mean, I wonder what you make of this. I mean, because I just think we need to be very different to the other side. In other words, where we disagree with people, where we have confrontations with people, we should be firm, but we should be kind in our responses.
That is a very, very important factor, to try to be as kind. Oh gosh, I have to work so hard to keep my temper down, because I'm proper, you know, Latin blood, and I just go, oh, you know, just off the deep end when I get cross with people. But I find that I'm forcing myself to be more patient and go the extra mile to make that explanation that is necessary without getting angry. It's an exercise in being a good citizen. And the people that do that are much better citizens than the ones that unquestioningly obey all these silly rules.
Fran, how do people follow your work and where can we find you?
Well, I'm back on Twitter, so I'm really happy to say you can find me on Twitter. It's at 2013Boudica, BOODICA. Or just type in my name, Frances Leader. I use my own name. The same on Facebook and on MeWe and on Minds and on WebTalk. I always use my own name, Frances Leader, so that people can find me. But most of my work, my articles, over 930 articles, are stored on Steemit and the Heart and Hive blog, and both of those are blockchain, so that I don't lose all the work that I have done over the years.
Fantastic. And I like the Boudica thing as well. It's the idea is to get the Romans trembling in their boots.
I'm going to do them Romans, Tony. I'm serious. This time I'm doing them Romans.
All right, Frances Leader, thanks very much for joining us.
No problem at all, Tony. Lovely to speak to you.